In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Christopher Edley. He is on the faculty at Harvard Law School. He is also the founding co-director of the Civil Rights Project. It's a multidisciplinary research and advocacy think tank based at Harvard, which is focusing on a number of issues that have to do with racial justice. He is also now serving a six-year term as a member of the bipartisan U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He's the author of the book, Not All Black and White, Affirmative Action, Race, and American Values, which grew out of his work as special counsel to President Clinton and also director of the White House Review of Affirmative Action. In that project, he was credited as the architect of Clinton's Mend It, Don't End It defense of affirmative action. After he finished graduate school, he began his career serving in the Carter administration. He was assistant director of the White House domestic policy staff. He joined the faculty at Harvard Law School in 1981. He served in the Dukakis presidential campaign as national issues director, and in 1992 re-entered the political arena as the senior advisor on economic policy for the Clinton-Gore presidential transition. He also served 2 years in the Clinton administration as a senior budget and policy official. He will be leaving Harvard this summer to become dean of the University of California, Berkeley's law school, and he will be here on this campus next week. He will be the keynote speaker in the campus's series of events to mark King Day. He'll be talking on the topic, The Affirmative Action Battle, New Directions for Civil Rights Movement. His talk is on Tuesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at Smith Hall Auditorium on South Matthews on the campus, and this event is free and open to the public, so certainly anybody in and around Champaign-Urbana should be welcome. Here on the program this morning, as we talk about affirmative action, I'm sure, and other subjects, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they're brief. We ask that to keep moving, get in as many people as possible. If you'd like to call, you're certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Edley, hello.
David, yes.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
When I read there are a number of articles about the fact that you had gotten the job at Bolt Hall, one of the comments that you apparently made to one of the reporters was that you referred to California as being ground zero in the nation's dramatic demographic shift to a multi-ethnic society. You're certainly going right into the jaws of the debate over affirmative action there.
I am indeed, yes. That and budget battles. The demographic shifts in California have really been astounding, and I think that one of the issues we're all confronting is that as our communities and our institutions change around the nation, what are we doing to prepare for that change? What are we doing to face it effectively? And in California, for example, in the higher education system, unfortunately, things are really evolving into almost a tiered two-class system, with Latinos and African Americans represented in very small numbers in the handful of elite top-tier institutions within California public higher education, but really dominating the enrollment in the community college system on the other end. So the budget cuts and the hikes in tuition are having a huge impact, disproportionate impact racially. And when the population is becoming increasingly Latino, this really doesn't bode well for the future economy of California or for their social cohesion. So these issues of grappling with the diversity, with the change that's taking place, are really quite dramatic in California. If they can figure it out, though, they will have important and valuable lessons for the rest of the country.
Hmm. One other thing that was mentioned, I think probably, and I read a number of stories about your appointment to this position, and I think one of the things that was mentioned in every one is that you would become the first African-American to lead a top-ranked U.S. law school, and it seems stunning, I guess, that in the year 2004, that would be the case.
Well, it is and it isn't. I think it's certainly unfortunate that it's something that still requires deserves to be remarked upon. Mm. But I think it's also true that too many people are under the false impression that that all of our issues of racial difference and progress, that we've completed that agenda, and we haven't. It's been only a short generation since the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the anti-discrimination statutes and so forth. Regrettably, I think a lot of people would just as soon close the book on the effort to erase America's history of color caste before really the work of repair has been completed.
Well, when I mentioned it, and that you were, you chuckled a little bit when I said that you were going into the jaws of the affirmative action debate there in California. Mm-hmm. But certainly, given the fact that now going back several years now, I guess five years or 4 or 5 years, that this was a place where there was a statewide ban on affirmative action, and there was a lot of concern about what that would mean to the numbers of African-American students, particularly in higher education. And I think the law school there, Bolt Hall, was one of the places where this was very hotly debated. And in fact, what seems to have happened, at least as far as African-American students is concerned, is what people thought would happen. That is, the number of black students has indeed gone down. Apparently the number of Latino students did initially. That there has been some, from what I read, there has been some rebound, but there's still a concern about overall the number of minorities and its relationship to the population, and then specifically the numbers of African American students there.
There is still a concern. I mean, the news this year is reasonably encouraging that with tremendous outreach efforts and a lot of heavy recruiting, the numbers for both blacks and Latinos and for underrepresented Asian groups are back to roughly where they were before that initiative. It's called Proposition 209, the ballot initiative in California. But it's going to take heroic efforts to maintain that diversity that people almost unanimously believe there on the Berkeley campus is an indispensable ingredient of excellence as well as central to the mission of a public university. I'd say that elsewhere in the university system, the rebound has not been as full, has not been as successful, and the diversity issues that I mentioned earlier are continuing to plague substantial parts of the university system. It's also a problem outside of the admissions process with respect to hiring. What's interesting is that just this past June, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the affirmative action cases involving the University of Michigan, ruled that certain forms of race-sensitive affirmative action in admissions are, in fact, permissible under the U.S. Constitution, if it's done properly. It's an endorsement of Clinton's mend it, don't end it position by a quite conservative Supreme Court in a narrow 5-4 decision. So you have the U.S. Supreme Court saying mend it, don't end it with respect to affirmative action. But the people of California a half dozen years ago made a political decision to end voluntary, and I emphasize that, to end voluntary public sector affirmative action in education and elsewhere. What we're really facing in the rest of the country, now that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that it's constitutionally permissible, is that we're facing now the political choice, the policy choice, of whether to use that constitutional flexibility through our political processes, through our policy processes, to continue to use affirmative action in a flexible, carefully, narrowly tailored way, the mend it, don't end it approach.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about your experience in the Clinton administration.
Sure.
When you were involved in reviewing affirmative action and then trying to develop an approach to policy that's characterized by that phrase that I used and you used, that the fact that we support the basic idea of affirmative action. We don't want to get rid of it, and yet maybe there could be some fine tuning on the way how it is we approach it.
That's right. To make sure it's done carefully, avoiding abuses, and to make sure that it ends when the need for it no longer exists. Well, let me set the stage. I mean, this affirmative action review arose in January back in 1995, and it was frankly a response on the part of the White House staff to a growing interest on the part of some Republicans on Capitol Hill to legislate an end to certain federal affirmative action programs for women and minorities. President Clinton decided in a meeting that he had with a small group of us that before responding publicly to this Republican initiative, he really wanted to do a thorough study of the federal programs and find out, as he put it, what works and what doesn't work. I had already actually packed my boxes and was ready to return to Cambridge to my professorship, but he prevailed upon me to stick around to run this review, which ended up taking about 6 months to do. We had an utterly fascinating series of almost graduate seminar-style discussions in the Oval Office with the President and the Vice President, a couple of aides, in which we really took apart the affirmative action programs in every detail. We debated the social science evidence, we looked at the legal decisions, we discussed social philosophy and moral philosophy, we looked at the history of the issue, we considered alternative strategies for designing opportunity programs, and at the end of it, in debating the pros and cons from every imaginable angle, at the end of it, Clinton arrived at what I believe and what he believed was a coherent approach to affirmative action across a wide range of contexts, from education to employment to government contracting and the like, that's really based on principle rather than on political polls. And it was this sense that even if this is controversial, it's the right thing to do. And he concluded that he just wanted to be candid about his sense that there remains an important need for these programs, provided they're done carefully.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Christopher Edley. He is on the faculty of Harvard Law School and has been there since 1981. He has been selected to become the new dean of the University of California, Berkeley's Law School, and will be going there this summer. He is serving a six-year term as a member of the bipartisan U.S. Civil Rights Commission and also is founding co-director of the Civil Rights Project. It's a multidisciplinary research and advocacy think tank based at Harvard that is interested in issues of racial justice. And he will be on the campus on Tuesday of next week. He'll be giving a speech. This was the keynote address of the campus's series of events marking Martin Luther King Day. It's free, open to the public. He'll be talking about affirmative action on Tuesday at 4 in the afternoon at Smith Hall on the U of I campus in the auditorium there. It's on South Matthews. And anybody here in and around Champaign-Urbana who's interested in attending should certainly feel free. Here on this program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I think that you mentioned, the Supreme Court decision of this past June of last year. Certainly people at educational institutions all around the country were looking at this very closely because they were saying to themselves, well, depending upon what the court says, we may have to make some significant changes in the process that we use to admit students. Is it clear exactly now from what the court said what is and is not permissible?
Some things are clear and some things remain to be worked out over time. There are two central questions posed in constitutional analysis of race-sensitive affirmative action. The first question is whether or not there is a compelling interest on the part of the governmental entity, for example, a public university, whether there's a compelling interest for pursuing affirmative action. And the second question is whether or not the policy, even if justified, has been narrowly tailored, that is to say, carefully designed to serve that interest. What was really the most important part of the decision was that the court resolved very firmly and very clearly, in quite sweeping language, the first question. That is to say, the court ruled that there is a compelling interest in race-sensitive affirmative action based on the interests of universities in diversity, in being inclusive, because the court was persuaded that by being inclusive, institutions can pursue a mission of educational excellence, in that a diverse student body leads to better education. People not only learn things differently, learn more things, but also become better prepared to lead, to work in diverse institutions and diverse communities, which of course gets back to the point we made at the top of the show about the changing demography of the country. The court, in Justice O'Connor's opinion, spoke eloquently about the changes sweeping the country and about the critical need for institutions of higher education to prepare people to work in that changing world. So that was the first point. But the second point, the second thing that the court decided was that to make sure that affirmative action programs are narrowly tailored, it's vitally important that they be flexible, that they not be driven by quotas, that they not be driven in a mechanical way by formulas or point systems that don't permit individual applicants to be compared with one another. That race, if used as a factor in decision-making, has to be used in a flexible way as one of many factors that weigh in the admissions process. Applying that second holding about narrow tailoring, the Supreme Court upheld the flexible so-called whole file review used by the University of Michigan's law school, but it struck down a point-based admission system used by the undergraduate school at the University of Michigan, in which a fixed number of points was added in the admissions process for any applicant from an underrepresented minority. And a majority of the justices had objections to that mechanical quality of the undergraduate system, even though a majority of the court upheld the flexible system at the law school. So just to sum up, what this means on a going forward basis is that colleges and universities may adopt race-sensitive affirmative action or continue race-sensitive affirmative action based either on the need to remedy discrimination, that's old law, or based upon this compelling interest in diversity, provided the way in which they use affirmative action is flexible, not mechanical, and that they revisit the policy over time to make sure that they really need it and that there aren't alternatives that would be equally effective at achieving the compelling interest in diversity.
When the court issued this opinion in June, Justice O'Connor was the one who wrote the opinion for the majority.
Correct.
And she said that, in her opinion, writes that we expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary. So she was saying and expressing the feeling of the majority of the court that this is something that we do still need, but that it is our hope and our expectation that we won't always need to be doing this. Given the fact that we've been talking about this since at least the 1960s, when the concept was first laid out there, in the mid 60s, one would have to ask, given that we seem not to have made a whole lot of progress in the past few decades, do we really think that in another 25 years, things will have changed that much? I guess I wonder, where we've come from, where we are, and where you think we're going.
Well, it depends on what day of the week it is and whether I'm feeling optimistic or pessimistic. I mean, I think look, anybody who works on civil rights issues has to be, by and large, optimistic. You have to stay hopeful because the work obviously is difficult and the setbacks are frequent. But if just putting on my law professor hat for a moment. I'd say the overwhelming view of constitutional scholars, civil rights scholars who've analyzed these opinions is that Justice O'Connor pointed to 25 years. And remember, that's just a number she pulled out of the air, thinking, well, it was roughly 25 years ago that the Supreme Court handled its first major case in this area, the Bakke case. So let's take another 25 years and hope that by that time we won't need this anymore. She pulled the number out of the air. It's aspirational. It's not a deadline. It's sort of it gives voice to, I think, what we all would hope, namely that society will have changed enough so that in order to achieve inclusivity, no special effort will be required. I mean, let me just pause and say, just for example, when I was a law student at Harvard, and I guess even when I first joined the faculty back in the early 80s, there was some affirmative action in the admissions process for women. But sometime during the decade of the 80s, I'd say, the need for affirmative action for women at the law school disappeared. And in fact, now the women are anywhere bounces around between 45 and 55% of the entering class. It wasn't that there was a faculty vote to do away with it. It was simply that there were enough changes in society that generated changes in the admissions pool so that we could get the diversity, the gender diversity we wanted in the entering class without having to do anything special in the admissions process, without having to pay attention to gender. That's a huge success that we should celebrate. In other words, the affirmative action for women died of natural causes, and that's worth celebrating. There's still lots of places around the university in which women are dramatically underrepresented, and there's still a need for some affirmative action. But similarly, the question will be, when will there have been enough changes in the pipeline, the K-12 pipeline, so that colleges and then graduate schools will no longer feel that in order to achieve this compelling interest, this higher quality of education through diversity, they have to pay attention to race. We hope sooner rather than later. Can it happen in 25 years? Well, let's look at another issue. If you just look at the question of the achievement gap in K-12 education between racial and ethnic minorities, blacks, Latinos, certain Asian subgroups on the one hand, and whites on the other hand, the achievement gaps are still quite substantial, I'd say even daunting. The real challenge, the real question is, are we going to put in place the public policies? Do we have the political, the moral will to make the changes we need to make in K-12 education so that those achievement disparities gradually, well, quickly would be bad, but I mean, so that those achievement disparities fade away? If we can achieve that, if we can do that, if we can accomplish that, then the admissions pools for colleges will start to be more balanced, and you won't need affirmative action in order to get diversity. So there's the question. I mean, what I say to opponents of affirmative action, what I say to people who are in a hurry to dismantle it is, I'm willing to end it the moment it's no longer needed. You tell me when the K-12 system will be repaired so that education disparities based on race or correlated with race and ethnicity disappear, and I'll tell you when we will no longer need affirmative action in college.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Other people who are listening are certainly also welcome to join with their questions and comments. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yeah, that point you just made about K-12 is very well taken. I think that's where the rubber hits the road in a lot of cases. But I'm not, you know, I think a lot of people aren't aware just how I'm Latino and just how amongst Latinos at least, how difficult that's going to be to change that because so many kids wanted to make a comment and a question. The comment was that I'm glad you're coming over here, from my point of view, I'm a little dismayed that this university is not as diverse as it should be. I think the most diverse university in this area is Purdue, and I think we should pay attention to how they manage to do that. Sure. And we don't seem to be doing that. But I have a question, and that it has to do with something I brought up with other people on this topic, and I've never gotten much of an answer, but you kind of touched on the subject area, at least, when you were talking about gender.
Yes.
And how it disappeared. And I don't know if you caught this or if you even regularly catch 60 Minutes, but they had this segment on what they termed an ongoing affirmative action for men and for boys, and that they looked at a high school in Boston, I believe it was Hanover High School, and they pointed out how the valedictorian and the person that ran all the extracurricular activities were headed by females, and like the
scholars
were females, and on the East Coast at least, that's really widespread, and they've had to do some under the table affirmative action for men in order to keep the balance in the universities roughly equal.
Right.
I was just curious if you saw that kind of thing in California, that would be like, in effect, holding back females. I was kind of curious if especially, I'm surprised nobody's taking up the banner. And, you said that affirmative action for females had kind of died of its own accord. But in this case, since men are being, helped.
Right, right.
I'm surprised females aren't complaining. Can you speak to that at all?
It's a great question. This is becoming a huge issue on a lot of campuses, where men are disappearing. It tends to be a more serious problem among minorities, but it's true. But it's true even for whites, for Anglos. And I've been in several conferences in which people have remarked upon this data and are trying to figure out what to make of it and what to do about it. And there are all kinds of sociological theories that are offered for it. You asked specifically about California, and yes, the same phenomenon is happening in California higher education. But you can step back and say, well, should we worry about this? Why should this suddenly become a cause célèbre? I mean, just to play law professor here for a second. Suppose one discovered that that there were more short people than tall people proportionately. Would we suddenly decide that this is a policy crisis and we have to make some special effort to understand the problem and rectify it? It's sort of an absurd example, but I guess what I'm getting at is that if the principle behind the design of your admissions policy is that you are trying to assemble a group that will enable the quality of the education to be as excellent as possible, then the question is, are you seeing a disparity? Are you seeing an underrepresentation with respect to some set of people or some set of attributes that's a vital ingredient of excellence? Now, I have a little bit of trouble making an argument that tall versus short is critical to the quality of the educational enterprise. I don't have any trouble, however, making the argument with respect to race and ethnicity. I think the argument with respect to gender is sort of in the middle. So what I want to do in the research that we need is to better understand what's producing this underrepresentation of males. It's not, by the way, just a matter of things that are going on in the criminal justice system. That only explains a tiny fraction of what's going on. It more has to do, people suspect, with differential expectations for boys versus girls in middle school and high school, and not enough effort perhaps being put in at the K through 12 level in seeing to it that boys, particularly boys that may have some behavioral issues, not seeing to it that they're really working up to their full potential, and that we have the same kinds of expectations for their success that we do for everybody else. So that's the kind of thing you really have to probe at it and see whether there's a quirk going on, whether there's some development that's going on that requires an intervention, that requires a new set of public policies, or alternatively, are we missing something that we need on campus in our classrooms in order to have an outstanding institution? I'm kind of troubled by what you report as the underrepresentation of minorities at Champaign-Urbana. It is because I do believe, as Justice O'Connor acknowledged in her opinion, I do believe that learning from each other across these lines of difference is absolutely indispensable for an institution that's training people to go out and be leaders. And that's obviously what the university is up to. So it's a hugely important challenge that deserves a lot of resources, deserves a lot of attention in order to improve the situation.
Well, I have some other callers here. I hope the caller won't mind if I go on. And the next person is in Mattoon on our line number two.
Yeah, hi. I was calling. I noticed in your discussion that rather than saying that affirmative action programs were designed to counteract an institutional imbalance among all minorities, that it's always stated that it's for to counteract an institutional imbalance among whites and then blacks, Latinos, and certain Asian groups. And I'm assuming this is kind of vaguely referring to the overrepresentation of other Asian groups in the educational systems, especially in the University of California. Excuse me. And I was wondering if you see that as possibly a problem to be addressed and how, if at all, that should be addressed.
No, I don't see it as a problem to be addressed. I don't think that I don't feel that there is I don't think the way to think of it is overrepresentation of any particular groups. Now, there may be an argument about the pie needing to grow to be bigger. That's certainly a problem in California, where the size of public higher education, just in terms of the number of slots that are available, the number of seats that are available, has not kept up with the population growth and the budget cuts. The starvation of public higher education in order to finance tax cuts or in order to finance the growing prison population, those things have really eaten into California's investment in public higher education, and the same thing is happening in several other states around the country. I don't know what the situation is in Illinois. So I would not say it's a problem of overrepresentation, but here's the point I'd make. Two things. Number one, I think many people make a mistake of lumping together all Asian Americans as though this is sort of monolithic, mm-hmm. And it's simply it's just not the case. The difference between, for example, Japanese and Korean Americans on the one hand, Hong Kong Chinese versus Southeast Asians, mm-hmm. is dramatic. Their socioeconomic circumstances, the education achievement, education attainment, dramatically different. There's no need for affirmative action in the University of California system for Chinese Americans, mm-hmm. for example. But if you ask about Filipinos or Cambodians, the answer is they're dramatically underrepresented, and in fact their socioeconomic condition is worse than the socioeconomic condition of most Latinos and African Americans. And the perspective that they bring is quite different from the perspective of somebody who's a third-generation Chinese-American. And including that perspective within the student body mix is going to enrich everyone as well as help the university fulfill its mission. So I think that kind of subtlety, that kind of sophistication is exactly what the Supreme Court was talking about when it said, if you're going to do affirmative action, you have to do it carefully. And that means a willingness to look closely, draw distinctions, not act mechanically, and keep your eye on the ball. What are you trying to accomplish and why? And the situation is going to change. Our view today about which groups need a helping hand to get the opportunity they deserve is going to be different from our view 10 years from now, because society is going to change. It's going to evolve.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Champaign County for the next caller. This is line number 3.
Hello?
Yes.
The diversity argument is fine, but I think people shouldn't give up on...
Can you hang on a second? We'll need to take you down because our last line didn't hang itself up, and we'll do that. There, we got you back. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I say the diversity argument is fine, but I think that people shouldn't give up on, even though it's complicated. Filipinos are a good example of coming from a colony up until 45. The idea of the redress of grievance. The first affirmative action was in Reconstruction, 40 Acres and a Mule, and it was betrayed. So I don't think people should give up on that.
That's a very interesting point. It's a very interesting point. Look, here's the way I think about this. I sometimes jokingly say that your brain is divided into two hemispheres, right? The left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And your left hemisphere is reserved for law, and your right hemisphere is for everything else. So if you're just thinking about things from the perspective of law, then the question is, what justifications for race-conscious decision-making? And remember, race is radioactive. That's our history. That's why we had a civil war. That's what the 14th Amendment was adopted to address. So race, from a constitutional perspective, is radioactive. Question is, what set of justifications are available for race-conscious decision-making by government? And what the Supreme Court has ruled over the decades is that only a very few justifications are powerful enough to permit government to pay attention to race. The clear one is to remedy discrimination, specific acts of discrimination by government that are reasonably recent in time. So when you were dismantling de jure segregation, when you were dismantling Jim Crow laws, when you're dismantling dual systems of public higher education that had segregated people, or when an employer has a history, has a pattern of discrimination, paying attention to race to remedy that situation, that's fine. What the court did in the Michigan case is it said not only to remedy those specific acts of discrimination, but another compelling interest is to pursue excellence through inclusion. So if you're a university, if you're a police department, if you make out the case that in order to do your job, you have to be inclusive and paying attention to race is the way to get there, okay. That's the constitutional argument. Now let me switch gears. After it's constitutionally permissible, then the question becomes, is it politically desirable? California, by a vote on a ballot initiative, has said no. The rest of us, outside of California and outside of the state of Washington, have to make that political case. Now, in making the political argument, you're not limited to just those few things that the Supreme Court has said are constitutional justifications. Now there's a broader set of arguments that we can bring to bear, including redressing grievances, including reparations, including this will be good for economic growth, including any sorts of arguments that are persuasive in the court of public opinion. And I don't want to, those are not unimportant arguments. I'm just saying that the courts have ruled that simply redressing grievances or simply saying this is going to make society better are not powerful enough arguments in a constitutional setting that they alone would justify race-conscious action. It's a bit complicated. Let me just add one more thought, and then I promise to subside. What the court would say, what a constitutional lawyer would say about the reparations issue, about the history of slavery, about the history of racial caste, about the Asian exclusion statutes and all the rest of it, what the court would say is those were horrible things. Society is free to do whatever it can to remedy the lingering damage done by those acts. But the strategy society chooses cannot be race-conscious strategies. You can invest in education, you can invest in health care, you can have welfare programs, but you can't have color-conscious strategies unless you have this compelling interest that they've defined quite narrowly.
Yeah, well, I think a better solution to all would probably be just having more access to higher education, free education.
For everybody.
Right. So then we wouldn't be fighting over the spoil so much. If we might digress for a moment, you can not. But I really, since we're on Martin Luther King Day, the anniversary, Voters' Rights Act. I see this case in Texas where Fort Worth, the minority community there, I think it's mixed actually, Hispanic and Black, has been divided up in five ways to gerrymander. And it's the court's decision, I guess it was appellate level, federal district, said that this was a political decision. It wasn't a race-based decision. Therefore, it's allowed to go ahead.
Yes.
Just absolutely. I mean, how can there? It's obviously it's both. I mean, it's and
right.
I just the Supreme Court is probably going to let it stand and
That's
not
right.
grant cert. It's just outrageous.
That's right.
And any short explanation of why you think that's the case? I mean, it's a no-brainer, as it's.
God, I mean, I don't know. I can't explain it. I just agree with you completely. I mean, this is. I can tell you what the reasoning is, and I think it's deeply flawed. But the reasoning is, just so that the audience understands completely. The question is, when the state legislature sits down to draw the map and decide congressional districts or state senatorial districts or city council districts, whatever, it's a given that in drawing those lines, they can be partisan. It's a given that they can, for example, try to protect incumbents, that they can, in other words, use political and indeed even partisan calculations in order to draw the lines the way they will. And if you don't like it, you vote out the legislature. That's the issue. It's not an equal protection violation to have partisan driven election redistricting. If, however, race becomes a predominant factor, then you've got a constitutional problem, unless there's a compelling interest, unless you are, in fact, trying to remedy underrepresentation. So the problem here is many people believe that the minority communities in Fort Worth were put at some disadvantage as a result of this redistricting. The constitutional question is, was the racial disadvantage intentional? Or was it simply the byproduct of perfectly legitimate partisan line drawing? And the court ruled that it was perfectly legitimate partisan line drawing. And if there's collateral damage for minority representation, that's okay so long as there was no invidious motive. Now, I just want to, so period, paragraph, here's the state of the law. The problem is that they're living on another planet. They're living on another planet. If I have an invidious motive, am I going to announce it on the floor of the state legislature? No. I'm going to couch my concerns in acceptable partisan language rather than be upfront about the fact that I want to minimize the number of minorities who are elected. I think that the Supreme Court is not being realistic in the way in which it's constructed this doctrine. It's not being realistic about the way advantages and disadvantages are handed out in the apportionment process, in the line drawing process, in state legislatures.
We are just about at the point here that we are going to have to finish, and I must apologize. We have a couple of callers. I don't think we're going to be able to take them because we're really up against the end of the program.
My apologies for being too long-winded.
We encourage, see, because we talk about things that cannot really easily be discussed in 30-second soundbite.
Right,
so we
right.
encourage our guests to take some time and some thought to answer questions. So that should not be, no criticism implied there of your performance. We certainly appreciate you talking with us. And I also certainly want to tell people who are here now listening to us in Champaign-Urbana that our guest, Christopher Edley, will be speaking on the topic, The Affirmative Action Battle, New Directions for the Civil Rights Movement, as part of the campus's observations of King Day next week. He'll be speaking at 4 in the afternoon on Tuesday in the auditorium of Smith Hall on South Matthews. It's the keynote address for the King Day events. And it is free and open to the public, and anyone who is interested certainly should feel welcome. Our guest, Christopher Edley, he's at Harvard Law School and will this year be going to California to become dean of the law school at University of California, Berkeley. And Professor Edley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Appreciate it, David. Take care.
All right.